Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Gary Hirsch. Gary's a man of many hats. He's an artist. He's a speaker. He's a writer. He is an improv expert. Through his company, On Your Feet, he and his team work with major corporations to teach their leaders how to be better listeners, how to give better presentations, how to harness their creativity, how to be better communicators, and so much more. Through his Bot Joy project, he helps bring joy through art to children and people all around the world by drawing robots on the back of dominoes. He gives keynote presentations. He paints murals. He is somebody who is constantly looking to give and give, make connections, and make the world a better place. He's an amazing guy, and I'm so thankful to be able to have him on the show with us today. This was a tremendous conversation, and I'm really excited to share it with all of you. Thank you all so much for taking the time to be here, listen, and learn from Gary. The conversation is going to take many turns, as you expect it might, with somebody who's an improvisation expert. The conversation starts with a tremendous and impactful story about the impact that Gary's dad had on him when he was young and would have nightmares about monsters. It really is a great story that I think all of us, but especially the parents, can benefit from listening from. He's going to talk about the three principles of improv, how we can all work to gain control over our fears, how we can improve our storytelling, how we can improve our decision-making, how we make connections with others, how we accept what we're presented with, the offers that we receive, when we can choose to make the most from them. This truly is a fantastic conversation. I wish I had several hours to talk to Gary, and now I'm excited to share it all with you. As always, thank you so much for being here. Please take a quick minute to like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show. Of course, leave us your feedback after. Thank you so much for being here. And a quick thank you to our sponsors as well. As always, we have HumanTel. Head over to humantel.com. Enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the best-in-class online training to understand what people are likely in thinking and feeling, by identifying when their emotions shift through their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com to get all your questions answered about not only what you will get from, but what you can give to the International Association of Interviewers. And of course, that's where you can learn about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation as well. And while you're online, please check out Inquasive. That's where you can learn more about the programs that our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams, to teach them how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. But now the reason why you are here, without further ado, I introduce to you Gary Hirsch. Good morning, Gary. It is so great to meet you. Thank you very much for being here. How are you this morning?
Great, Michael. Nice to see you as well. I'm good. A little early. I'm here on the Oregon coast and it's still dark. So besides that, there's coffee. So we're good to go.
Well, I appreciate you setting your alarm a little bit early for us today. And if you need to reload on that coffee, feel free. I certainly won't stand.
You'll find out.
I won't stand in your way there. I'm really excited for this conversation. Legitimately, we were introduced by a mutual friend. And as soon as I started researching who you are and what you do, I couldn't get you on here fast enough. So thank you very much for your time. And as we were talking before we hit record, and people who listen to the show know that of all the things I do, first and foremost, I'm a dad, I guess, slash husband is part of all that. But, you know, I'm a dad and I have a young son. And when I was reading your about section on your website, there was a very interesting story, which I will just summarize so I don't screw up your story. But essentially, when you were young and you had nightmares about monsters, you would wake up and you would draw them. And for me, I thought, well, that's really cool. Then I keep reading that your dad would sit up with you while you were doing that and then had a conversation with you that says, you know, if you can create these monsters, you can also erase them. And then that helped you get through that stage of your life with the nightmares and so forth. So as a father who can always learn to be a better dad, more importantly than anything else, the first question I would love to ask you is, what impact on your life did those conversations with your dad have?
They were huge. They were huge. I mean, yeah, I still learn from my dad all the time. He's no longer around because I keep remembering his impact. He was quite a remarkable human being. My dad was he was like this polymath. He was a cardiologist, a poet, a activist. He drew and he was a concert pianist. So this guy was like, it was kind of crazy. And it was a very creative household. There's a lot of things going on in that house. There's piano being played all the time. And when I was a really little kid, I would draw, doodling, and I still do. You will never find me without pen and paper. I'll be doing it here. And it totally directly relates to what your expertise is. I listen better when I doodle. So that's an impact already. But when I was young, I would have these, as you just summarized, these horrific nightmares, and they were really, really vivid. And they were these kind of nightmares where you would think you woke up from them, but you hadn't. So I think there's a name for that. There is. Someone's going to tell us. And they were super scary, and they had all these really visual creatures in them. And so the ritual in my house, I was about 7 or 8 years old. The ritual was I would get up and I would go into my parents' bedroom, and my dad, being the most generous soul on the planet, would be like, "Well, let's go down and see what your nightmares are." And see what your nightmares are meant put some cinnamon toast into the toaster, sit in the kitchen, and I draw them for him. So I'm drawing all these crazy monsters. And the beautiful thing is my parents saved those. So I have those pictures still today.
Wow.
And I can send you some, you can post them through or whatever. But I would draw those, and they would make that would make me feel better. So in the impact immediately was art helped me reduce my anxiety and fear. And then there was a moment w at one night after several months of this, my dad was like, and I was drawing them with pen and paper, a pen and pencil. And my dad would said, "You know, if you make these, you can also make them go away." And so, to your point, it gave me an eraser. And I started to erase these drawings and talk about the impact of that, which is like you can have control over the things, you have some control over the things that you are afraid of. And so that was like a pivotal moment. And it's funny how memory is, right? So I remember this sort of, I also remember it with conversations with my dad, and I have the pictures. It all comes together in this sort of foggy but still clear memory. I guess to your question, the impact has been, A, that I have some sort of agency over the things that bring me fear, that bring up things for me. And there is so much power in the way that artistic expression can help people. It can support people, it can celebrate people, it can ride alongside with them and be a witness in terms of art. And that's impacted everything that I do artistically. And I split my artistic life up, or really merge them together, as a performing art and then as visual art. So I've been trained as an improv performer. I started training as an actor, and I do improv. I've done it forever. I run this consultancy called On Your Feet, which uses improv off stage with businesses and teams. And then I'm an artist, a visual artist, and all those things come together. But the theme really starts from the impact that I mean, it starts there, but it's a pivotal moment, which is my dad giving me that gift of knowing that.
It's an amazing story. And for me, as a father of a young son, reading it, even just hearing you say it, like the ability to take some control over fear. You know, with my son, he'd be probably upset if he knew I was telling the story. But this poor little kid last summer got stung by bees or wasps 3 times in a very short span of time. And he didn't do anything wrong. He just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and got hit. So now he's like deathly afraid, to the point where I'll be like, "Well, how was school today? I don't ask him that question. I'm sorry. The first question I ask him is, "What was the most fun part of your day today?" That's always the first question I ask him. And a lot of times it's recess, which it should be for a kid in elementary school. I've got no problem with that. And he sometimes I'll say, "Well, not so much recess because I was worried about the bees." And it's paralyzing to him sometimes. So I try to talk about the difference between being aware and afraid. Like, it's okay to be aware of things, but being afraid can be paralyzing. And so finding ways to take the control. And my son does love to draw. He's now fascinated with Dog Man and Cat Kid and
Oh
Captain
yeah,
Underpants and all
Dan
those.
Pilkey. I love Dan Pilkey. He's amazing.
So maybe we can start drawing bees. I'm going to steal your father's idea. Maybe
Yeah, I mean,
start
that's
drawing
an
bees and see what
idea.
helps.
It really reminds me of this whole other project that I have, which is Bot Joy, which is
Yes.
the project that, and I have one here. I can even describe it really quickly because it's really similar. So I started to draw these little robots on dominoes, like these little things you could hold. And I made brave bots and love bots and joy bots. And here's one. So I brought one, so I figured we'd talk about it. So this is
Yeah.
a bot, right? That's
Very
just a
cool.
little robot. It's sitting on a domino. I sign it, I number it. So there it is. And for example, I would give Brave Bots here in Portland, I would donate them to the children's hospital here. So when a kid gets admitted to the hospital, they get a Brave Bot. And the operating instructions, they come with little operating instructions, and they say things like, let this watch you. And when you feel afraid, it'll give you a little bit of courage. And it seems to work. It's sort of weird. It's like this, I don't understand actually how these things work, but people have them all over their desks. And like, I do a lot of work over at Nike, and there's like Joybot sitting there. So when people are feeling a little bit down, they're like, the Joybot goes, it's cool, because here's some things to be happy about. Of course, it doesn't talk, right? It's a piece of plastic that I drew. But this whole idea, back to your son and bees, it's like, really, he's got the power, to your point, to help him work through the story of bee stings and just be with the reality of a bee sting. The story of bee stings is harder and more out of control than what would actually happen if he got stung by a bee. It hurts, you deal with it, right? But these little things, this is another way I think about art. It's like, it's there to kind of have a conversation. He could have a conversation with himself. It's like, oh, wait, you're brave. You've got some courage. Here's some things that'll help you right now that you're feeling scared. Of course, it's not talking, so you're doing it for yourself. And that's the way I think about art now. It's like, this is the evolution of those nightmares have turned into things like this. And now that it's got sort of a movement going on with these things. Like, there's hundreds of people that just make them for other people. On my website, I just put up this button that goes, steal this idea, because I don't want to be the bottleneck if people want these things. So now there's lots of people doing it. So art is sort of being passed on in that way. So I just thought about that as you talked about your son's bee sting, because I do believe, you know, this is obviously, we're talking about sort of a lot of emotional things right now, but I think art has the power to help with what I believe. So that's kind of how I use it.
Yeah. And for me, that's what's so fascinating about this conversation. Like, a huge part of why we do these episodes is to pursue better communication and better listening and really better relationships and better outcomes through as many different outlets as we can. And I'm an appreciator of different forms of art, but I've never saw myself as somebody with an artistic brain, so to speak, to think that way, which is why I think it's awesome to watch my son draw the way he does. I love that he expresses himself that way. But whether it's self-expression, control of our emotions, control of our fear, building confidence, it can be a way to communicate with others through pictures instead of words. I really feel like there is so much to learn and unwrap here, if you will. And I love something that you said earlier, using art to overcome fear. And if even with the bots, and I think after this, I'm going to talk to you about some potential alternatives to continue stealing that idea. But even with that, like, giving yourself, it's almost, I'm using the proper word for it, but it's like people have lucky charms. Yeah. So whatever it is that gives them that internal strength or that reference, this is another way to do that for
people. Yeah. It's like, I think the word I keep finding, at least out there, is this idea of a talisman. It's like, it's a thing that you can endow with power. It's just a thing, but you can endow it with something. You can give it something. And I do a lot of street art as well. So I do big, big murals, and it's kind of it's similar, but different. When I do murals, what I'm interested in is I put questions in them. So I put these things get really big, but they have a question embedded into their design, like, what brings you joy, or who inspires you? And the idea there is to have you sort of, you're walking down the street, you see this sort of cool, giant, weird creature, and then a question pops into your mind that you get to decide to interact with. And people, you know, we're moving so fast, and things are so incredibly distracting that if I can get people to slow down for just a moment and ask themselves a question and actually have a small micro insight for themselves, like, who inspires you? If you're rushing down the street because you've got 16,000 things to do and you suddenly that question pops into your mind, even if it takes you 5 seconds to think about it, I feel like that is helpful. And again, I'm interested in having art help. Can it be helpful? So I'm always exploring different ways to do that.
Which is fascinating. And so now I've got to find opportunities to pivot the conversation, which with you should be pretty easy to do, which I'm looking forward to. So I'm probably not doing this right, but we'll improv a little bit as we go to get from art to improv, because I do feel like from an outsider's perspective, and please correct me everywhere I screw this up, you talked about being an improv expert. So that's one form of art, but also painting and drawing, and that's another form of art. I would imagine that creativity streak in your brain that allows you to find possibility or connective tissues where other people might miss it is a common theme, whether you're creating art through performance or whether you're creating art on paper. How far off base am I?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's almost, there's a third piece here. So there's the art forms themselves, right? So improv is an art form. The objective of improvisation, if you're in the audience, you want to go be entertained. You want to go see some people do things you can't do and sort of be in witness of that. Improv is a little risky. So sometimes you're like, I want to be around risk that feels still sort of safe. It's like going to a horror movie. It's like, I'm not going to get killed, but I can watch other people. So it's like, there's a lot going on there from an audience perspective. What I'm really interested in is that connection piece that you talk about, because I mentioned behavior is what it is. So when improvisers get on stage, there's something that I found fascinating, and I found this early on. And I was trained, I wanted to be and was participated in a lot of scripted theater through grad school and undergrad. But I couldn't memorize scripts. I was just like, oh my God, I hate this idea of having to, what are these words? And one day I walked in, this is in grad school, I walked into the long rehearsal room and suddenly I was with a bunch of improvisers instead of the scripted actors. I was like, that's what I want to do. That's amazing. What happens on stage with improv is that it's all about connection. People put things out into the world. They're allowed themselves to be sort of vulnerable. They've got a lot of confidence. If you get up there, you can imagine you don't know what you're about to say in front of a bunch of people. I mean, Public speaking is like the number one fear of everybody, but improvisers run towards it. It's like, I don't know what I'm about to say. You guys are waiting here for me to say it. I'm going to say it. So I got really interested in the behaviors that improvisers use. How is it that they are able to collaborate by creating connections with each other, to your point, in a way that feels joyful, that feels generative, that gets them somewhere? And those behaviors is what I've got really interested in. That's how we started On Your Feet. For the last 28 years, we've been using principles of improv and other interactive methodology to help people in organizations, help them be better presenters, generate better ideas, better communicators, give each other better feedback, and be better collaborators. And all of that is making a connection between what improvisers do on stage as an art form and what could be useful off the stage. So my brain is actually always looking for, like, my brain basically is always going, what could you do with that? And improvisers even have a word for that. So it's called an offer. Anytime someone does something on stage, we designate that. That's an offer. So if you and I are performing a piece of improv, Michael, and even by accident, I trip over my shoelace. Didn't mean to happen. Didn't want it to happen. It happened. So what do we do with it? We don't go like, oh, shoot, can we redo the scene? Because that wasn't supposed to happen. We're like, no, that's the offer now. So that's the language. So how do you use whatever shows up? And that's a connection behavior.
I love that. And as I start making random connections myself, that line, how do you use whatever shows up? I feel like perhaps completely off base or unexpected, it ties in identically to how my former teammates and I used to interview. As we go into these cases, multiple suspects, no evidence, everybody's already been interviewed. There's no real rational reason why we should be successful here. So I need to sit down and have conversations with people and use whatever shows up. I've got to get them talking. I got to feel what they need to experience in this conversation. I've got to start collecting puzzle pieces without knowing what the final picture is going to look like. And I might get far enough thinking this is an ego and be like, oh shit, it's a whale, and right. Have to go a different direction. So I love that concept of using whatever shows up. I feel like that's amazing.
Well, here, so you've sort of proved my point. So you're talking about using improv in a completely non-theatrical, you've never would use the word improv when you're doing your former work, right? But you are, because there's three things you're doing that we would say, you come in with an improv mindset for that situation, probably other lots of things in your life, being a dad, kind of everything. Yeah. So one line we say is, the only time you're not improvising is when you're dead, because nothing goes as planned. So think about this. You come in, you the same scenario you just described. You've got already other teammates who've done this interrogation more. You're in there too. You're participating. The three principles of improv mindset. And again, everyone's got their different language. This is ours. Let go. Notice more. Use everything. So I'll say it again. Let go. So you come in, I'm going to let go of what I thought was happening here. I'm going to be open for something. I'm then going to notice more. what's that person do? I mean, I don't know your work at all. This, I'm making this up, but I can do that. I never remember. So I'm going to notice more. This guy's like shifting a bit in his chair, or she's like moving her hair a lot. I don't know what that is. Maybe there's something behind that. Use that. What are you going to do with that? So you let go of your preconceived notions. You notice more in front of you, and whatever shows up, you do something with it. And there's a whole, I mean, that's, you know, that's a multifaceted workshop right there.
Yeah.
Luckily, we get to do, because it's incredibly interesting, incredibly fun, and massively useful. So yeah, it's there.
That is, I hope everybody listening just got a pen and wrote that down, because to me, the power in those three steps in every conversation we have is critical. And I do feel like in a lot of ways, you just described what we were taught to do in completely different circumstances.
Isn't that crazy? I know. It's beautiful. I think it's beautiful that there's application across. This is that connection thing.
Yeah.
It's so great that you noticed that.
No, I love it. And especially when we're talking to like some of our executive clients or sales clients, people are so worried about having control that the best way to have control is to let control go. Because if I let control go, you let your guard down. And when you let your guard down, you give me more. I can notice more. I can use it somehow. So I am absolutely.
I mean, not only that, Michael, you know this. This is your work. And everyone listening knows this too. The most compelling presenters, the people you want to be in the room with, are coming off script.
Yeah.
They are letting go of control. They're noticing something and using it, right? They're like the CEO that gets up there in front of the all hands and the projector goes out and the technology doesn't work. The ones that go like, who did this? Who's responsible? You're like, ugh. The ones that go like, no worries. Give me a whiteboard and a pen. You're like, holy mackerel. We did this piece of training for a huge, well-known a technology company, and we were training their presenters. And these presenters would get rated at the end of these things and these conferences. They're like, so their colleagues would give them like a score, basically. And so it was high stakes for them. These meant something. So we're doing all this training, and this one guy, his name was Steven, he was all prepared. He gets up there, and I'm in the audience because I was coaching, and everything goes to hell because he goes, here's what I think I know about you. And he tells the audience kind of what he thinks their current state is. And one guy gets up and he goes, no, that's not relevant anymore. What's relevant is this other thing. Everyone in the audience goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. So something had changed since he had planned. So he turns off his computer. He does get out the whiteboard because he goes, here's the good thing. I know something about this new thing that you're now, you want to know more about, you're concerned about. He literally makes up the speech and he wins in terms of like hundreds of different presenters and their scores. Like, that's what we want. That's engaging because it gives us what we need in the moment.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm going to say that over and over again in this conversation. But to your point, you speak at events, I speak at events. You can tell when you're watching a speaker that walks to the same point on the stage and says the same thing in the same way that they do every time. Then they take the same pause and they walk to the next and they do the next. And it will get me, no matter how valuable their content is, it will get me to get up and walk out of the room because this is such a rehearsed thing that there's no actual connection. There's no actual interaction. It comes across as no real care for the audience and how I'm going to apply it. You talked about confidence earlier, having the confidence to do improv. And I've never been trained in improv. I don't want to act like I have in any way, shape, or form.
You're already doing it.
Thank you. I feel like some of the ways that I learned to do a lot of what I feel like is similar to a lot of the things you're talking about, let me say it fairly, is by being out on the road by myself and having things just go wrong. Right. Whether the AV doesn't work, whether the fire alarm goes off, whether I'm in a conference room next to a pool in Los Angeles when they've got jackhammers and they're renovating the pool to, you know, role playing, you know, all of these things where things could be different. But I do at the same time feel like the ability to be successful in those moments comes with maybe it's unintentional or not. It's not the preparation for that specific thing. Like, I'm not going out to say, well, if UPS fails to deliver all of my materials to the hotel in San Jose, I can still go a full day without any support materials and teach the same stuff. So I'm not preparing for that. But the experience and the expertise I've picked up along the way allows me to be able to execute in that moment. So for you, as you are maybe not working with people to memorize scripts per se, because we're trying to develop that confidence to improv, how do you help people tie their previous experience or knowledge base into the confidence necessary to be able to improvise on their feet?
Yeah, that's a great question. Really cool question. here's one thing. I agree with you. I don't think it's about having had previous exact experience with the content of the thing that could go wrong. I completely agree with you with that. I mean, somehow us as human beings, you and me, we've survived. Here we are. Like, it hasn't gotten us yet, whatever it is. So we've been able to manage it, right? So some of it is just to remind people that as a human, they have an innate ability to be able to deal with the unexpected, because we do. And some of that is just to remind them, have them, we do a lot of storytelling in our presentation skills work. So some of that is having them just tell stories of when they have been able to do this, to improvise, like to your point, like the materials didn't show up.
True story.
We give them some language though to help them with that. So what's the offer here if the materials don't show up? What can I do with that? Is there something I could actually make? Can I make that even better? You know, here's an example of that. We were doing a keynote for a large company, and the audience was like over 400 people. And we were working with the planners of that company for what we would do. And we're like, here's the deal. We could do a number of things in the morning to help kick this things off. And one of them is like, give them some really important tools. And one of them is to give them an experience. And in that experience, they will have to sing. And the planners are like, they will never freaking, you're out of your mind, never going to happen. And we hear this a lot.
Sure.
Never going to happen. They're never going to do it. And we're like, okay, cool. Can we ask them? And they're like, what? It's like, yeah, can we give them a choice? Which I love to do on stage, which is like, what do you need in the moment? And so we asked them, we were like, would you rather do this or do that? And they're like, oh, they're going to do that singing thing. We've been out late. It's like, we did it, which had, by the way, it wasn't just singing for the hell of it. It was singing for a really rich, important point. And we made it. And that was a piece of improv we could do because we've had that exact experience. When we train people, though, what you do is you give them language. What's the offer here when something goes wrong? What can I let go of? You had this thing that you wanted to have happen. And we'll teach them that through experiences. We just did a piece of sales training. And in that, again, role play, I don't really like that word, but I think it describes what it is. We essentially just played the audience improvising. We were like, so someone's up there doing their thing. And I would be like, hold on a second. What about this? Wasn't in the script, wasn't planned. You give them some practice just doing that. You know, you said something really from the beginning of this. I think maybe you said in our pre-interview. It's like sometimes when people ask you, when you ask people to do these interviews, they want to know what questions you're going to ask. And you think that's funny because they're talking about themselves. And I say the same thing about things that go unexpected. You know this content. You don't need to keep memorizing it. Nobody would have asked you to do it if you didn't. You're an expert in the thing you're talking about. So now let go of that and serve the needs of your audience. The only thing you should do as a presenter is figure out what your audiences need and be able to deliver it in real time. That's what I believe. That's it.
I love the use of the phrase. Oh, I'm sorry. Go.
That's improvising, because you don't know what your audience needs really till you show up.
I love the phrase real time. I think that's very important. It's not a qualifier would be the right word, but I'm going to use qualifier because whatever. People can laugh. That's the word I got right now. earlier, you used talisman, which might have been the word I was looking for. And when you said it, I was like, thank you. We now know who the smartest person in this conversation is. I appreciate you finding the word that I couldn't. And you might run into this too, where when we're getting ready to work with clients, they want to tell us how unique their situation is. And they go on to tell us basically how nearly identical it is to most of the other things that we've dealt with. There might be nuances involved that are unique, but I do agree with you because of that a lot of times we don't find out what the audience really needs, whether it's something that's formally planned or truly improvised, that is planned to be improvised, until you start interacting with them.
Nope.
Because maybe management thinks they need one thing, but they need something else. Maybe they believe they need something, but as they open up in the conversation, you connect the dots and say, ooh, that's really not what they actually need. Based on what I'm experiencing now, we can make this situation better by giving them something else. So as you work with people to use these offers and to do more, you mentioned storytelling earlier. How do you work in storytelling to the offers to help people open up to the experiences that you see they need?
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. That's right through it. So first and foremost, this is, you're kind of basically talking about that discovery phase of working with a client, right? It's like they come to you, you know, however it is you guys connect. The first question I will always ask is, what do you want to walk out with? It's another way of saying, what are the objectives?
Yeah.
And again, that seems obvious, but a lot of people don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I essentially want to go, I want to understand what people want to walk out with, right? We want our presenters to be more engaging. They're putting our people to sleep, but we want to generate new ideas around X. So I want to discover what that is. And then what we'll do is we will start to either, as you said, listen for what they care about. That to me is the most important piece. And that is a different type of listening. You have to do that first before you start to talk about you or what you're going to do to help them. Storytelling is a way to get them to talk in a way that you can listen for what they care about. So here's what I mean by two of those things. Listen what they care about is a different kind of listening. It's where you pause, you shut up, you ask them a prompting question like, tell me what it would look like if, is one way to go, give a story, that's a story. What does it look like now, is a story. So there's lots of ways to prompt people into storytelling. Story is meaning, in my opinion. Words are words. If you tell me, I want our company to be more creative, that means so many different things to different people. If I say, tell me a story of what it looks like to be creative here now, tell me a story of what it would look like to be creative in the future, and tell me a story of what it looks like to not be creative. Those are stories of fact, stories of possibility, stories of contradiction, actually. Tell me those stories, and I then get an opportunity to listen for what you care about underneath those words. So I don't really say a lot during that, but at the end, I say, wow, it sounds like what you care about is this. So I'm not interrupting with solutions. Like when they tell me, like, here's the problem. I'm not going, like, oh, here's how we can solve it. Nope. I'm not telling them about my own experience. Oh, yeah, you got that problem. So did this other company that we worked with. I'm just listening for what they care about. And then I am saying, here's what I think you care about. What happens is they do what you're physically doing now. They head nod, which is a huge indicator of connection, in my opinion.
Yes.
People are like, yeah, right. I see that in the audience, too, when I'm presenting. It's like, oh, there's head nods. I'm feeling better. They head nod. You build personal credibility and connection, and they're apt to tell you more stories because you're not there in sort of solution space yet. It's a juggle because obviously you're also there to, in the end, sell them a service, right? So you want to display value. But I think you mean display value through our own behavior and allowing people to be more themselves. And I think story does that.
At an 100% alignment with, we differentiate ourselves through our behavior, how we show up, the type of questions we ask, the way we listen. But to your point, how we extrapolate the key components of what they said and show it to them. So
right.
They likely didn't tell you, this is what I care about.
Nope.
You had to let go, accept everything, and figure out how to use it. And by letting go, you now start, you put yourself in a mindset to connect dots that people who are in the check the box mentality, I'm going to ask every client the same five questions. They're never going to pick that up. So now you connect dots that people might not have realized were even there to connect. And they immediately feel like Gary gets me. Gary understands.
And here's the thing. This is why, weirdly, an improviser who basically doesn't have a ton of business background, although I do now because I've worked with so many businesses. So the thing that's pretty awesome is that you can use this work with, like, for example, sales in a sales context. So we do a lot of sales training because, to your point, you want to help people in sales listen for what people care about, then be able to improvise around that. They've got something that could be useful to this person, but in what way? In how? What's the specific need that this piece of decking or lumber or something could help this contractor, for example, right? So have people get deeply curious, listen to what they care about, which means letting go, using what shows up, and noticing more. So if you let them do that, then connect the thing they've got to the need and dream that emerged from that conversation. And to do that, have them tell stories of other people that have used the same thing, that have the same needs and dreams that this person has, to help them sort of move it on. But again, move it on to the sale or the thing. But obviously the sale is the objective, but the objective is to meet the needs and dreams of this audience. And the only way you can do that is to listen in the moment. So that's how we apply it.
That's fantastic. And the way that I like to ask the same question is at the beginning, what do you want everybody walking away thinking, feeling, and doing?
Yep.
And then often, especially the thinking and feeling part, as they answer that, they're generally answering that just as much for themselves as they are for their group or their audience. And now we can start providing them with that feeling, which gets them to open up, which then allows us the right to tell those stories, like you said. So instead of walking in and saying, well, I've worked with all these other companies and these are all the awesome things we did, you should want this too. We listen to what they care about first, confirm that, then tie it in after.
Yeah. Yes. I think that is absolutely the way to think about this. And this is why story, if you think I would add to that is, I've really have found that words, I think words, there's certain words that are just, I call them fat words. They can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. Creativity, talked about this earlier. So when clients are talking about the things they want, they, in their minds, they know what those words mean. And in your mind, you sort of think you know what those words mean from other clients, right? But actually, sometimes it means a lot of different things. So I think story is the way to bridge that gap. It's like, here are the challenges we're running into right now around X, Y, and Z. They're telling you and they're using these words and we're head nodding because we're like listening in an active way. And we're like, yeah, I know what that is. But I still go, tell me a story what that looks like. Because that's the place where you're like, oh, that's what you mean by. Story is meaning, actually, in my mind. So that's why it's a massively useful tool. So we do a lot of storytelling training. We help people tell stories in a way that's more compelling, more engaging, and simpler. Just a simple way of doing it. And improvisers know everything about storytelling. It's the only thing they do on stage. They're telling stories with other people. It's a co-creative storytelling act, basically.
And even that phrase right there, a co-creative storytelling act. If I'm coming in business development, the example we were just working through, it's not me selling you something. We are co-creating a series of experiences that will lead to preferred outcomes. If somebody works for us, I'm not telling them what to do. We are co-creating the experience that will lead to this. My bias is that if we are communicating with somebody, if we're having a high value conversation, which could be anything to anybody, if there's real value in some combination between the relationship and the outcome we're looking to achieve, then the thing that I should prioritize the most is your experience. If I prioritize the experience that you need to have in this conversation for you to choose to commit to whatever comes next, then I'm more likely to listen for what I care about. Listen for what you care about, right? And then help paint that story and tell that.
I want to draw you because it's the only way I think about this. I'll give you a visual on that. It's really a bad visual, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I'm just drawing.
It's better than anything I could draw. I promise.
No. This really is like seriously just a shitty visual. But here's what you got. You've got this triangle up here. So let's call them your presenter, right? And what they do is they get really interested in their own content. Mm-hmm. Right. So they're like, I'm going to prep and I'm going to get my slides right. And I'm going to be an expert 16 times over because I know my stuff, but I'm going to keep. And then they get in front of an audience. They're over here. So presenter, content, audience, and they open up their fire hose and they kind of go, here's all the stuff I know. What I'm most interested in is this part. This is a two-way arrow. And this is presenter to audience. What happens in here? Can you understand the needs and issues of your audience? Can you pivot? Can you change and be flexible? This is really the only type of presentation skills training I do. We do it on your feet, my team, which is looking at these dynamics and getting people comfortable in a two-way flow of conversation information, even in a giant audience, right? Doesn't matter. So I think a lot about it. And again, this goes back to the thing we said earlier. It's just about meeting the needs and issues of these people in the moment. That's what this is about. But most presentations get prepped through this. Oh my God, know it, prep it. Check it in with 16 other people, give it. And I like to build in dynamics in any presenter where I can make sure that happens, not just to keep it going. So that's kind of how we think about it.
And then for the people that might be listening and not watching, basically that was a triangle. And if you go from the top down one side, that's the I memorize and I give to you. So I memorize it, I get it approved going down one side, then I come across the bottom of the triangle and give it to the audience the way I memorize it. Where you have the other axis of the triangle, that's the two-way conversation, where it's in a lot of ways it's shortcutting the longer route, the going around the long side to just getting straight through that two-way conversation to meet people where they are in the moment, listen to what they care about, learn more, do more with it. And I like what you said in that word pivot too. So for me, when I start thinking about something that you said earlier. People come to you and they say, we need to be more creative. That's like when people come to us and say, we need to communicate better. Well, thank you. That could mean roughly 89 million different things. So let's try to work our way through that. I love your tell me about what that might look like or walk me through an example. I think that's a great way to help with that.
Story it.
I imagine for people listening to this, one of their mental blocks might be, well, I'll have to, if I do that, I'll have to get creative. And I'm not a creative person. So if I'm going to make this more audience oriented, if it's going to be less memorized, if I'm going to add a little improv to what I do, that's going to force me to be creative. And I don't necessarily see myself as a creative person. That's different for me. How do you help people unblock themselves so they can start accessing even components of the latent creativity that they have inside somewhere? They just have to figure out how to ask it or access it.
The only way to do that is to have an experience that proves they are creative. And they are. I mean, honestly, again, back to, they're still alive. So they're creative.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just, that's the baseline. And you don't have to be a Picasso to think of yourself as. So our workshops are massively experiential, right? We'll do storytelling. I mean, honestly, Michael, we could even do it right this second as just an example. We'll do storytelling that proves they're creative and they don't have to memorize things. And the way we'll do it is we might have an experience like this. We'll do a storytelling experience where let's say that you are going to tell us a story of Dan's shoes. Okay. That's the title of the story you're going to tell right now. And you're just going to improvise it. You're going to start talking about Dan and his shoes. And I'm going to yell out a word that's got nothing to do with your story, Michael. And you're going to incorporate it into the story somehow. Who knows what that word's going to be? And then I'm going to let you do it. And we're just going to do this for a little bit. We won't even finish the story. I'll just give you a few examples of it. So let's just play with this right now. You and I are going to improvise. You start telling the story of Dan's shoes and use the word. I want to interrupt you, which I will. Just use that word in the story. Go for it.
Okay, cool. So here we go. So Dan was a high school basketball player who always had an affinity for a specific pair of Charles Barkley basketball shoes.
Cadillac.
And as he got older, he found a shoe store that sold, I'm going to use the word antique shoes, even though it's not really an antique. He sold antique shoes. And so when he called an Uber to go see if they had the Charles Barkley shoes, he was surprised when they showed up in a Cadillac. So now here he is feeling big time
shooting,
in the back.
Shooting star.
So now he's feeling big time in the back of this Cadillac, but he's still wondering, are they going to really have the shoes or not? It's kind of getting late at night. He's not sure if he's going to get there before it closes or not. And then as he looks out through the windshield, he sees a shooting star go through the sky and decides that must be a sign.
Right there. You could keep going, and we could keep going. In our workshops, we would. You already did it. You use the stuff that shows up, right? Did you think you're going to be telling a story about a guy in a Cadillac Uber who sees a shooting star? No. Were you able to take it and do it? Yes. Was it the most brilliant thing in the world? Who knows? It might be. That could have been the best story ever. And it does not matter. It's all completely disposable. The thing is, you had the confidence to jump in and do it. You did do it. And what is creativity? It is making connections that haven't been made before. There's nothing new under the stars. But does anyone ever told that story of a guy looking for antique Charles Barkley's in an Uber looking at shooting stars? No. So therefore, you are creative. And you give people that experience. Now, how does that feel? Some people feel like that was hard. That was embarrassing. I wasn't sure. But it's super disposable. And you just did it. And if you do it with a group of other people that are your peers, and you get them to a place of feeling it's safe enough to play, which we do, you don't have to tell them they're creative. They will realize it.
So it's, and then weird, when they realize it, they own it.
And they own it. So it's weird. It's playful. It's not, you know, what people normally do, but you don't hire us to do what people normally do anyway. So, I mean, we're a group that's founded on improv and interactive conversation and collaboration. So yeah, that's how we do it.
And that exercise takes me back. And again, one of the things I'm fascinated by are parallels in seemingly unrelated things. So when I worked for WZ for doing interviews and interrogations, Dave Zaloski, one of the founders of the company, like an uncle to me, would occasionally walk upstairs. And as soon as he said, Michael, what are you working on? The answer was, it doesn't matter, Dave. What would you like me to do? But after that, quite frankly, he'd come downstairs in the conference room with me. And sometimes he would do it, or he would already have the video camera set up, and he would say, talk to the camera about this. or he would sit in front of me and say, give me your introductory statement or give me your rationalization on this or whatever it was. And then he would start throwing in curveballs. And now we have to figure out how to work our way around them.
Same thing, so, right.
And what it ends up doing, at least for us, is it starts to look like you have an answer for a billion different things. But I didn't. What I had was a three-step mental framework. So it didn't matter what was thrown at me. I just had to put it in the three-step mental framework. And more times than not, it would come out with something hopefully productive in order to keep the conversation going. So I'm fascinated by things that are completely on the surface, unrelated. People would never associate the two, but yet they cross over. And I would, the same has to be true in parenting. I never know what my kid's going to say, but I know that I want some sort of lesson in forward movement and strengthening of the relationship to come out of whatever it is.
Right.
In business development and leadership. And as you know, being on stage, somebody raises their hand. God only knows what might come out of their mouth next, but right. There's a professional parameter that I've got to answer that. And there's something that I need to tie it back to in order to be able to move us forward. So I love how it comes together. Personal question that might not mean a whole lot to the conversation. For me, I used to love going to watch bands play. I would still love to go watch bands play, but as a father and a husband and a business owner with a million other things to do, the schedule doesn't allow for it. But for me, one of the things I would really look to pay attention to is when the instrumentalists, guitar player, bass player, maybe a fiddle player, keys player, whoever it was, would know when to play their solo and when to stop. Because that's not how they recorded it. And it's not, sometimes I might see a band a couple of times in the same weekend. That's not how they played it Friday night. So I would try to pay attention to what's the singer doing differently. Like, what's this? Like, Joe Strummer was famous for having the signal behind his back that he would do to the band, okay. And they would catch right. that and they would go. So earlier you talked about watching people's behaviors. So as you are either interacting on stage or maybe interacting with audiences in front of the stage, I know context is king or queen, so it's going to be different in situation to situation. But how do you work on catching behaviors and tying the behavior to the offer or opportunity it creates?
My gosh, the thing about that is I'm not quite sure I know how, because that is something that happens so naturally. And I think we all do it, but we just don't do it under a lens, right? It's like driving. When you drive and somebody, you just innately know that guy did not stop it long enough at that stop sign. Like, you feel it. Like, there's things you sort of feel. Your observational skills are massively. Remember, we're tuned into thinking about our biology is saber-toothed tigers in the tall grass. We're like, we're always kind of looking out, right? So we are really good at that. We're like, our radars are up. The idea here, I think, is to be comfortable with, be comfortable with whatever shows up from that. It doesn't have to be. Here's the thing about improv, which I think is a total misnomer. If you really watched what was funny on stage, you would be surprised. Because if we do an improv scene together and people are laughing their eyes off, but then you go back and read the manuscript of the content, it's not funny. The thing that's funny is how the improvisers are interacting and using each other's stuff. That to me is the most entertaining and engaging piece. And we all do it. We just don't do it consciously. And that's what's called accepting the offer. Accepting the offer. We talked about offers earlier. An offer shows up, you tripped over the shoelace. I could block the offer by saying, no, let's start that scene again. Instead, if you trip over a shoelace, I need to accept the offer. I need to say something like, we've been working on the shoelace time, Michael. How come that's not working? Or drunk again, or whatever. I use the thing that shows up. So it's not how you use it is not that important. Accepting means you recognize the offer that shows up and you use it. Blocking means you don't recognize it and you don't use it. That language, that vocabulary is improv based, but it's applicable to everything in life and work. So I think that's me rambling, but the short answer here is, how do you use what shows up? You accept it. You go, I'm going to recognize it and do something with it. If you don't want flow in ideas or conversation, block things. Say no. I'm a really huge fan of this quote. It's from Keith Johnstone, who wrote a seminal book and the seminal training of improv that I got to work with in my day. He says this: there are those that prefer to say yes and those that prefer to say no. Those that say yes are rewarded by the adventures they have. Those that say no are rewarded, same word, by the safety they attain. And in his observations, there's far more no-sayers in the world than yes-sayers. So I really try to live a lot by that credo. When I say yes, I create possibility, I create flow. When I say no, I block it. Sometimes blocking it is appropriate, but most of the time I want to take what shows up.
That quote is, what's the name of the book, by the way?
Called Impro. And there's another one called Impro, yep, for Keith Johnstone. And then Impro for Storytellers is another one. Both are amazing. And they're about improvisers, but they're about life.
I will add links to both to the show notes, along with all of your links, of course, and we'll get to that. But I will add links to those in the show notes so people can look them up. I will be adding them to my purchase list for sure.
They're great.
And it's when you talk about accepting, again, to tie this back to my former career in interrogation, we used to tell people there's a difference between accepting and agreeing. Somebody can tell me something that I might objectively know isn't true. Somebody can give me an excuse, but I've got two choices. I can call them a liar. How well has that ever worked out? I can shut it down, tell them I don't believe them or that's not true or they need to take responsibility or blah, blah, blah. All of that's going to make them defensive, but I feel righteous and great because I stepped on what I knew to be untrue or an excuse. So congratulations, me. Or I can accept them for how they want to be perceived in this moment in time. And then I can travel in that direction to get them to go wherever I need them to go later. And maybe a dated analogy, it's like back in the day when we would have to read a map to know how to get someplace. We didn't have GPS to tell us every turn. So I could look at a map and say, well, if I want to drive from Seattle to Portland, there's a direct route. And that more often than not, that's probably the fastest route to take. But there could be thousands of combinations of roads that will get me from Seattle to Portland. So I could take the water if I had to. I could fly. I have all these other options. So depending on the time of day, traffic, construction, where I want to get coffee, am I going to stop and meet friends? Do I want to take a picture, go sightseeing, whatever? I might choose these different roads or these different options. And that's why I will go back to letting go. When I let go of which road I need to take to get there, I can be more successful in getting to not only just getting to where I want to go, but what I experience and what I collect along the way. And the examples you've given today are utterly fascinating. And I hope people are listening to, they can apply it in every conversation and every relationship in their life.
That's awesome. I love that. I completely agree with you. There's a huge difference between agreeing and accepting. You know, if someone comes to you and they say, I want to get off work early at 3, you can just say, no, that's a block. You can say, we can't do that right now. How about tomorrow? So you're not agreeing with them. You're accepting the offer. You recognize it and you give them something to work with. And they can work with accepting or blocking tomorrow, right? That's flow. When people are accepting and accepting and accepting, conversations move. When people are blocking, they stop. And you don't have to agree to accept. I completely believe that. So I think that's right on.
It maybe sounds kind of funny, but even just saying, okay, I want to get out of work at 3 o'clock today. They're praying you'll say yes, but they're prepared for you to say no so they can argue it. So when they say, I want to get off work at 3, and I say, okay, now their brain's in a pretzel. They don't know what to say next. So they have to listen. Like,
thanks. Yeah, I mean, that's when you don't need flow. So that's an acquiescence. You just say yes or you say okay, but you don't need that. If you need permission, that's cool. If they want to co-create something with you, however, it'd be cool to say, okay, but how are we going to work with this in the future? Right.
And that's where I'm going. So it doesn't end at okay. There's that pause where their brain gets pretzeled because I wasn't ready for that. So now it's okay. Where are we at on X? Exactly. How far along are we on Y?
For
what we were going to do for the next 2 hours today, how does that slot into your schedule tomorrow? Yeah. Or maybe it could even be okay. What's the emergency? Or, well, turns out my daughter is sick at school. Well, then right. We'll figure everything else out.
The okay is the recognition. The other pieces are the recognize, do something with.
Yes.
You just recognize, you're acquiescing. Okay, done. If you say no, you're blocking. So I think the most generative reaction is an acceptance. Recognize, do something with, create flow. It goes back to the word we talked about earlier, which, by the way, if I have to put one word on top of everything I do, it's around co-creating. I'm most interested. I call myself sometimes a co-creative junkie. I want to make things with other people, and that's conversational. That's art, that's solutions, that's problem solving, that's being creative. I want to do that with other people in a way that is generative. And co-creation is the door to get in there.
And thank you for doing that with me today.
Yeah, we did.
is you're sitting here, I can actually see the sun coming up in Oregon.
No, I know. It literally has. So
it's getting lighter in your room. Do you have time for me to ask you just one more question before we wrap up?
Sure.
So when I was doing a little bit of research before we got on, I see that one of the things that you talk about is making better decisions. And as people reflect on me and my life, I would get no shortage of examples of decisions that I could have made better. Yeah. So I am curious if you could kind of wrap up by talking through the improv process. I'm assuming, how do we arrive at making better decisions, or what does that process look like?
Yeah, wow. Well, from an improviser's point of view, you're co-creating this together, right? So on stage, you know, if everything is an offer, you still can't use everything, right? So if I'm on stage and there's three other people on stage, I can't work with all of them at the same time. I have to make a decision towards it, right? There's improv is a nice, safe place to practice some different types of decision making. It's like, you don't have enough time to ask yourself, why am I talking to this person and not that person on stage? So you just do it and see where it generates and where it goes. So a lot of this is about trusting that your instinct could be right. But if it's not, it's not the end of the world. So to me, this is about an internal dialogue. The improv has a lot to say about feeling, taking risks in a way that feels still has some safety. Mm-hmm. Decisions are sometimes like that. Sometimes they are not. But we don't have crystal balls. We don't know. So is it right to say yes, no, or maybe? We don't know. So what's for sure true is if we don't do anything, it's still a decision.
Yes.
So I think it's about taking a bit of a leap into the unknown, and that's about finding comfort in it. I think that's the relationship between decision-making and improvisation.
I love it. Thank you. Again, I'm losing my words here right at the very end, of course, but my friend talks about, making like the active or passive decisions.
Okay.
If I've got a choice to make an active decision or a passive decision, they're both decisions, and the active decision comes with risk, but the active decision is most likely the best path to go because it creates, it's like the old choose your own adventure books that we used to read when we were kids. It's going, maybe that's the page that I fall off the cliff, but by going that way, it's opening up more possibilities for us. So his rule is often if I'm presented with an active or a passive decision, I'm making the active decision and not the passive decision.
I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah, that's cool. That's great.
So let's wrap this up by talking about where people can find you. You talked about On Your Feet. You talked about Storybots. You're out there doing public speaking. I have no doubt that people are listening to this going, I need more of Gary.
Oh, well, that'd be sweet. That'd
so
be awesome.
Where can people go to connect with you, to learn from you, to get involved with you?
Yeah, easy. There's two places you can go. And they sort of splits in the way that I talk about my work. So all of the consulting work I do is with On Your Feet. On Your Feet is, we somehow got this early. It's OYF.com. So O is an on Y your feet F OYF.com is everything you want to know plus more about On Your Feet. Tons of video and blog and other conversations around this. And then my artwork is under Botjoy, which is the name of that bot project. And a lot of my other artwork lives under that too, as well. My paintings, my murals. So Botjoy, BOTJOY.com and OYF.com.
Awesome. Well, I will share all of those links and more in the show notes so people can connect with you directly and they don't have to go looking for it.
Okay. Awesome.
Thank you so much for starting your day with me today. I truly appreciate it. I had to cram notes in between notes on my notepad over here as we were talking. I got so many great nuggets out of this conversation, and you didn't need to get up and get a second cup of coffee. So
you kept me wide awake, Michael.
I feel really fun. A little bit better about that. So thank you so much. I hope we have the opportunity to keep in touch and keep the conversation going.
Sure,
it's really been my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, man. Take care. I love it.
Talk to you soon. Thank you. Gary, thank you for such an awesome conversation. If I tried to recap everything I took from that conversation, I just end up repeating everything that we spoke about. But I truly appreciate you waking up early and starting your day with us out on the West Coast. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you sharing the conversations that you had with your father and how meaningful that was for you. Certainly helps motivate me to be a better dad and how I spend time and work with my son through some of his fears and what he experiences as a young boy. But man, everything you shared today is so much value. Just the idea of listening to what people care about. It's not listening for what we want to say or what we want to do, but give ourselves the opportunity to listen for what people care about and then prove to them that we caught it. Connect those dots that they didn't realize connect. Just the idea of letting go. Let go. Use whatever shows up. Let go. Observe as much as possible. Use whatever shows up. You can either accept an offer or you can reject an offer. You know, creativity is just connecting dots that other people haven't connected yet. a truly amazing conversation, one that I hope people go back and reference and continue to take notes from, because if we apply your mindset, that improv mindset, that creative mindset to all of our high value conversations, we can significantly increase how we build our relationships, the opportunities we unlock, the outcomes we unlock, the impact we have on other people's lives. Thank you for all the joy you bring to people. Thank you for all you shared with us today. I truly appreciate it. I hope all of you appreciate it as well. Thank you for spending another hour with us today. Again, please take a moment, like the show, share the show, subscribe to it, share your feedback with us. We'd always like to hear it. I'm trying to get on as many great people as we can, like Gary. If you know of anybody or have any recommendations, please share them. We would love to have the conversations. As always, we want to thank our sponsors. Before we leave, we have Humantel. Please head over to humantel.com. If you've ever thought about improving how you can recognize what people are thinking and feeling by recognizing on-time emotional changes through their facial expressions and nonverbal communication, Humantel is the place to go. Enter Inquasive25 for 25% off the best-in-class online training at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn all you need to know about the certified forensic interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify, pass the exam? What could it mean for your career? That's also where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers, not just all of the great educational and network benefits you get from it, but also what you can contribute to it as well. And while you're online, please head over to Inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, their sales team, their negotiators, their HR teams, and so much more, to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to unlock hidden value in all of their high impact conversations. Thank you for being here week after week. We truly appreciate it. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.